Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The year in Talking Point. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is a special year-end edition of To the Point from Public Radio International. Every day on our program, we bring you a talking point on an issue or an event that's helping to define the national conversation, even if it's not leading the news. Today, a collection of our favorites. We'll hear a report on how easy it is to build an assault rifle the government can't trace, an argument for why the Middle East needs a sexual revolution. We'll talk with a civil rights lawyer trying to memorialize every lynching perpetrated on American soil. I'll ask National Book Award winner Ta-Nehisi Coates to make the case for reparations. We'll also listen to some Motown with biographer David Marinus, who's documented the rise and fall of Detroit. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, back with this year-end edition of To the Point. That's the sound of Andy Greenberg firing a 10-round magazine using the ghost gun he made in his office at Wired Magazine. It's a metal AR-15 that required no waiting period, no background check, and no serial number. This summer, he wrote extensively about it in Wired, and he told us the story beginning with just what he means by ghost guns.
This is a gun basically that I made myself. Legally speaking, I didn't buy this gun. I fabricated it. And in fact, the thing about a semi-automatic rifle like this, an AR-15, is that only one part of it is regulated, the lower receiver. That it's the body of the gun, according to U.S. gun control laws. And so if I can just make that one part, and I did, in fact, three different ways to test them all out, then I can essentially skirt all gun control laws and without breaking any laws, obtain an entirely untraceable ghost gun, a gun that the U.S. government has no knowledge of.
And not a plastic handgun, as we've seen being printed out in other places, but rather a metal automatic that we just heard it can fire. I take it you took it to a gun shop and had them check it out?
I did. In fact, I showed all three of the lower receivers that I'd made to a gunsmith in the Bay Area near Wired's San Francisco office where I did all of this work. He basically told me that this metal one that I'd used a computer-controlled milling machine to make, this new machine called a ghost gunner, created exactly for this purpose. He told me that the lower receiver I'd made with that machine was perfectly safe, essentially just as safe and durable and effective and accurate as the lower receiver of any AR-15. My ghost gun, my AR-15, was really, just because I made it, it was no less effective than any gun that you would buy normally after going through a background check and showing ID and all of that. When I first wrote about the ghost gunner, this CNC mill, this computer-controlled milling machine that can carve gun parts out of metal, essentially, I was flooded with comments on Wired.com telling me that people have been able to do this for a long time using basically old-fashioned power tools, a drill press. So I tried it that way, too. That was much cheaper, but actually, I have no power tools experience. I'm not a handy kind of person, and I totally failed to pull off that method. So then I also tried with a 3D printer, which is something that people have written a lot about, to make the same part. And I did 3D print this lower receiver in plastic as well. That was very expensive. A 3D printer cost nearly $3,000. And in the end, I couldn't quite finish that one to the point where it was able to be used either. But the CNC milled one was about $2,200, including all the parts of the semi-automatic rifle, which I could order online, even using Bitcoin if I'd wanted to, showing no ID or any sort of regulation whatsoever. And, you know, that was a totally professional quality gun.
So you can obviously then create a gun for relatively low cost that can't be detected by law enforcement or traced in any way?
Well, that's right. In fact, this was more expensive than an AR-15 that you might buy in the traditional way. But this was not just a regular AR-15. As I've said, this is a ghost gun. This was a gun that had no way for the government to know about it. If I had been mentally ill or had a criminal background, any of that, I still could have created this in my garage. In fact, I did it in just a back room of Wired's office with not much help. And it was a relatively private process. And that's exactly what about ghost guns appeals to kind of the libertarian gun-loving American who sees his relationship with his or her firearms as a very private affair.
Is this something that could disrupt the gun industry?
Well, not yet. It's for one thing, I had to buy most of the parts of my ghost gun off the shelf. I mean, they were pre-made parts. There was just this one piece that I had that I made myself, and even that I was really just finishing a kind of raw chunk of aluminum that was 80% of the way finished. That's as close as you can get, and not sort of trigger it, not so to speak, any gun loss. So I wouldn't say that this is by any means a more efficient. In fact, it's a really inefficient way to create a gun. The important thing is that it is essentially a blank space in America's gun control laws, and people are using it, and it's becoming easier and easier to exploit it.
Is it a good idea for everybody to know that this can be done, and it can be done so easily, and that you can make your own automatic weapon, which would be might be illegal to carry if you don't have a permit or a background check, or and you're making it without a serial number, that so it can't be traced? Are you concerned at all about the consequences of this?
Well, I think you're asking two questions. One is, am I concerned about the consequences of the possibility of these guns and the fact that they're not regulated, that you can easily make a ghost gun at home and circumvent all gun control? I think, of course, that should raise concerns. But this is not like a political piece where I'm advocating for new gun laws. I was really just trying to show how this works, to really get deep into it and essentially prove that it's easier than ever, which I think I did. But I think that the second question you're asking is, am I worried about the consequences of exposing this, of showing the details of the process? Of, you know, some people might accuse me of having written a how-to piece here, which I don't think I did exactly. I mean, but I, as a journalist, I guess I believe that it's important to delve into things that scare us, and gun control laws only really make sense when you know what's possible, and that's what I'm trying to show here.
Well, thanks to Andy Greenberg at Wired talking to us about his ghost gun. In a moment, much more of our favorite interviews from 2015 on To The Point from PRI.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with this special end-of-the-year edition of To The Point. In 2015, U.S.-backed negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians hit a diplomatic wall. There is no place that demonstrates the complexity of that conflict better than a tiny street in Jerusalem called the Alley of God. It's the subject of a book published this year called A Street Divided by Wall Street Journal reporter Dion Nissenbaum. He lived there, and he describes the street this way.
It really is a street unlike any other in the world. It's a tiny 300-yard, dead-end, narrow, cobblestone street with jasmine and bougainvillea on the sides. If you look at it, if you walk down the street, it looks very, very calm and quiet. You wouldn't know that it really is sort of the front line of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And that's because in 1948, it did become the dividing line between Israel and Jordan. That's where Jerusalem was divided. The barbed wire ran down the middle of what was then essentially a shepherd's path. And ever since then, Israelis and Palestinians have been divided along this street. So the western side of the street is all owned entirely by Jewish Israelis, and the eastern side of the street is technically East Jerusalem, and this is where Palestinians live primarily. So the street itself is sort of a physical, cultural, psychological, and demographic divide separating the two.
Do the two sides of the street look different?
They do, in fact, look somewhat different, and this is a result of the controversial development policies in Jerusalem. So on the western side of the street, there are a number of apartment buildings that have gone up over time, and they rise above the other side of the street, which is where Palestinians have a lot of difficulty getting permits to do what their residents on the western side of the street do. So it looks much more cramped and crowded on the eastern side of the street than on the western side of the street. Over the decades, as these families have lived here, there have been periods of cooperation and division that sort of mirror the broader conflict. So there's some incredible stories from the street from before 1967, when they were separated by a barrier, where there were families that lived across from each other that traded flowers. Palestinian man gave flowers to an Israeli woman on the other side. There was a little bit of a real life Romeo and Juliet story there between an Israeli girl and a Palestinian boy. But those relations started to sour after the barbed wire came down. And then as their conflicts sort of engulfed Jerusalem over the decades, walls started going back up. And now you see less and less people talking on the street. So I lived basically on the second story of a building overlooking Asa El Street. So I was actually there to see a variety of conflicts play out on the street between different families. There would be fights primarily between different Palestinian families on the street that had different ideological visions and conflicts. But my rooftop looked right down on the street, and I lived there for 4 years and got to know these families during my time there. And that's why I wanted to tell their stories, because they're sort of at the heart of this conflict, and this book was meant to sort of give the people that are living on this front line a voice for what happens to them while these peace talks languish and nothing seems to be happening to solve the broader political conflict.
There's nothing simple about this, of course, and you're beginning to give us a sense of how diverse it is on both sides.
Yeah, there's incredible characters on the street, real-life characters. There is an American-Israeli family that moved there that are sort of the peaceniks of the street that do a lot of proactive outreach. The wife tries to use yoga and New Age Reiki treatments on her Palestinian neighbors to try and bridge the divide. On the Palestinian side, there was an Arab man who has Israeli citizenship and actually is the most ardent Likud supporter, the ardent supporter of Benjamin Netanyahu. He doesn't even consider himself Palestinian. There are Iranian Jewish families that lived there and were sort of the early ones to try and bridge this divide in the 50s and 60s that ended up moving to Mali Adamim, which is one of the big settlements outside of Jerusalem, and they became very conservative and soured on the idea of a two-state solution. There's a Palestinian family there that's lost two men in its family over the decades to Israeli snipers in conflicts. So you've got sort of an incredible cast of characters that all live within a few hundred yards of each other.
Did you move there because, as a Western journalist, you wanted to be able to tell a lot of interesting stories?
I certainly didn't know, you know, what I was, what kind of neighborhood I was moving into. This neighborhood, Abu Tor, which is sort of between the old city of Jerusalem and Bethlehem, on a hillside known as the Hill of Evil Counsel, where some people believe that Judas betrayed Christ to the high priest, the Jewish high priest. It's known as a neighborhood where you can sort of see both sides of the conflict, and a lot of journalists try and live there so you can sort of feel what's going on, and you do feel it all the time in this neighborhood. It is often consumed by conflict. Last summer when we were there, there was fears that the Third Intifada was going to sweep over this neighborhood, and so it is a good bellwether for larger conflicts that take place between Israelis and Palestinians.
If there is a Palestinian state, is it likely to become the border again?
Well, this is, to me, this is one of the most fascinating things about this street, is there is a proposal for this street to once again become the dividing line, for it to become the dividing line between Israel and Palestine. And there are a lot of good reasons for it to be the case. But politically, there are a lot of people, including the current Israeli prime minister, who believe that dividing Jerusalem is a non-starter. So we'd have a long way to go before you would see this happen. But it's an interesting discussion about where the line should be drawn. And I think this street, more than any other in Jerusalem, sort of captures the difficulty that we all have and that politicians have in trying to draw lines between people and cultures.
It sounds as if there's not a lot of violence on Asa El Street.
There isn't a lot of violence on Asa El Street, and a lot of people do feel like that the years of bridge building have helped it remain relatively quiet. But the streets right below it are often consumed by violence, and that was the case last summer as well. So it does have the potential to be a bridge still, but it's often strained, and it's a story that's still being written. So we'll see what happens with these families as the years go on.
Dion Nissenbaum, author of A Street Divided, speaking to us back in October. Now let's turn to gender politics in the Middle East. Mona El-Tahawi is an Egyptian by birth. She's author of Headscarves and Hymens, Why the Middle East Needs a Sexual Revolution. In one chapter, she writes about when she first moved to Saudi Arabia and was, in her own words, traumatized into feminism. I asked her what she meant by that.
I meant that as a 15-year-old girl who had to adjust to life in Saudi Arabia after being, you know, brought up as a Muslim by parents who, in my opinion, were very feminist. They met in medical school. They got their PhD together in London. And then we moved to Saudi Arabia, where essentially women are the walking embodiment of sin. And I say in my book that as a woman in Saudi, you have two options. You either lose your mind or you become a feminist. And at first, I lost my mind because I fell into a very deep depression. And then I discovered feminism and it saved me.
When you lost your mind, you covered yourself up.
I did. The headscarf for me was a way to save myself from two things. One was from men's eyes and hands, because the levels of street sexual harassment in Saudi Arabia, including at the holiest sites for Muslims, Mecca during pilgrimage, and just in ordinary day life, were just unacceptable and just horrific for me as a teenager. But also because, I heard, in school and religious education that a good Muslim girl covers her hair. And so I struck this deal with God. And I said, I hear a good Muslim girl should cover her hair, so I will if you lose my mind. And I now joke that God didn't keep his side of the bargain.
Tell us a bit more about what it's like for a teenage girl in what you describe correctly, of course, as some of the holiest sites of Islam.
Well, Saudi Arabia generally treats women as children for their entire lives. They have a system there called the guardianship system, by which females basically have to have a male's permission to do the most basic of things, whether it's to travel, whether it's to get some surgical procedures. As many people know, women in Saudi Arabia are not allowed to drive. And, what's interesting about the holy sites for Muslims is that, first of all, women cannot cover their face. So that, for me, negates this argument about the need for Muslim women to cover their face. But here I was as a teenage girl performing the pilgrimage 3 weeks after my family arrived in Saudi Arabia. This is one of the five pillars of Islam. This is a very spiritual place for Muslims because the cubical structure, the Kaaba, is where in Mecca, where Muslims pray towards five times a day. And yet there, as we were performing the rites of pilgrimage, I was groped by a man behind me and I was groped by a Saudi police officer. And this for me was just horrific at the age of 15. And it took me years to be able to actually say this and tell my parents what had happened to me.
You've continued to feel guilty after taking off the scarf.
I did because, I began to wear the headscarf when I was 16 years old in Saudi Arabia. I wore it for 9 years, but I say that I fought or struggled for 8 years to take it off. And what I discovered, and that's something that I share in my book, is that it's much easier to choose to wear a hijab or headscarf than it is to choose to take it off. So that's one of the things that I discuss in greater detail in my book, this idea of choice in what I call a modesty culture. And in order to connect this to a culture that your listeners can understand, I liken it to the pure purity culture in the states in the South here in the United States, where, you know, the Christian right wing have created this so-called purity culture that holds up virginity and the purity of girls up to such a degree that, you know, I can connect this modesty culture from my Muslim background to this purity culture. And I essentially say these are cultures that unfairly burden girls and women with this idea of what it means to be good and virtuous. And so I question this idea of choice in either of these cultures, because they're not choices that men are asked to make. And so I challenge them head on in my book.
What choices do women have?
Well, the choice that a woman has, in my opinion, in the Middle East and North Africa today, is this choice to launch what I call a social sexual revolution. And that's essentially a revolution that takes on a trifecta that basically holds or promotes misogyny in my part of the world. And that trifecta is the state, the street, and the home. So be it political, or on the political level, on the legislative level, on the street level, or on the home level, where the patriarch lives, these are the revolutions that we as women must fight for in order to free not just ourselves, but our countries. Because without a social sexual revolution, you know, I've been on your show many times, Warren, to talk about Egypt. All we've essentially done there is replace one man with another. So whether it's military rule or Islamic rule in the form of the Muslim Brotherhood, these are all authoritarian rules that only benefit men. And for our country to be truly free, we must start talking about gender equality. Because with 50% of our society not free, we will never be all free.
When you talk about the state and the street, tell us what happened to you when you were attempting to cover what we were referring to as the Arab Spring in Cairo.
In November of 2011, I was assaulted by the riot police, who broke my left arm and my right hand, and they sexually assaulted me, and then I was detained for 12 hours. I was also threatened with gang rape by the supervising officer of this of the riot police, and I later found out that at least 12 other women were assaulted in ways very similar to mine. And that's why I say it's the state and the street working often in unison, because this was a state, the regime at the time was the military junta that took over from Mubarak. It was the same junta that also subjected Egyptian women revolutionaries in March of 2011, just a month after Mubarak stepped down, to so-called virginity tests, which are essentially sexual assaults. And it was able to do that, and that the regime was able to sexually assault us during the protests in November, because the regime knows that the street and our society also, well, homes subject women to so-called virginity tests in order to ensure that they're virtuous before they get married. And the street clearly assaults us, because a United Nations survey has found that more than 99% of women in Egypt, as basically all of us, are subjected to street sexual harassment. So this idea that this trifecta works together, the state, the street, and the home, this must be the focus of our revolution if we truly want to free ourselves of the Mubarak in the palace and the Mubarak in the home and the Mubarak on the street corner.
If things are as difficult for women as a result of the state and in the street, what can women do at home?
I think what women can do at home is to recognize that in the way that they broke through that idea that the public space is a male domain in Egypt, because that's essentially, that's one of the biggest achievements of the revolution, in my opinion, that women were out there protesting side by side with men. They took that power back home. And that power back home is now telling fathers and brothers and sons, we demand respect and we demand freedom. So I think in homes, mothers and daughters and sisters all have a role to play in creating that revolution at home. But I also call on Egyptian men and men in the region generally to join that revolution, because, you know, we often hear this phrase, feminism is good for everybody. Well, in the case of the Middle East and North Africa, that is also the case. And I also make the point that fighting misogyny at home isn't specific just to my part of the world, because misogyny hasn't been wiped out anywhere. All the countries in the world lie on a spectrum of misogyny, but some have made more progress than others. So what I'm saying in my book is, when we fight the revolution at home and we take it out on the street, and we keep that open channel, that's our way of planting our flag on the map of global feminism. But we also acknowledge our sisters in India who speak out against sexual violence after the Delhi gang rape, our sisters here in the US who created the movement hashtag Black Lives Matter after Trayvon Martin was murdered, our sisters in Turkey who insisted on burying a rape victim because they didn't want the men to touch her anymore, even though it's against Muslim burial practice for women to carry out burial services. So I see this as a global feminist moment in which the revolution moves back and forth between the home and the street as a way for women to say, we will no longer wait until we solve all of these problems in order for you to recognize that misogyny harms us all.
Mona El-Tahawi, speaking with us in April about her book Headscarves and Hymens. We'll take a very brief break, and when we come back, more of our favorite Talking Point interviews of 2015, including Ta-Nehisi Coates, the winner of the National Book Award. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with this special year-end edition of To the Point. This summer, research by the Equal Justice Initiative revealed that there were 3,959 lynchings of black Americans between the end of Reconstruction in 1877 and 1950. That's 700 more than previously reported. Brian Stevenson is the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, and he's working to put up historical markers for every lynching. He's a Harvard-educated lawyer. He's argued cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. He's also the grandson of an American slave. When we spoke in July, he defined lynchings this way.
What we really mean is racial terrorism. I mean, there were lots of communities that had hangings in the frontier West. There were communities that didn't have functioning criminal justice systems where you would see this sort of frontier justice. Lynchings and the terror lynchings that we document actually took place mostly in communities that had a functioning criminal justice system. But people of color, African Americans, were deemed not good enough to get the respect and decency that a criminal trial assigned to you. They were directed at the entire African American community. They were acts of terror designed to traumatize the community of color and make them complicit and compliant to racial hierarchy and segregation. You couldn't get black people to just agree to segregation and racial domination by passing laws. You had to reinforce that through violence and terror, and that was the primary role of these lynchings.
What were some of the reasons that people were lynched?
Well, I mean, I think there's a misconception that this was done in response to crime. A very large percentage of these terror lynchings were really for violations of the social code, the social order. It was for going to a white person's house and knocking on the front door rather than the back door that people got lynched. It was for laughing inappropriately, not getting off the sidewalk when white people passed, having too close a relationship with a white woman, carrying a note. The suggestion of intimacy got a lot of people lynched. We have accounts of returning soldiers not taking off their uniform as a provocation that resulted in lynching and violence. There were allegations of rape and murder from time to time, most of which evidence would suggest were not true, but a huge number of these were for violations of social norms and customs.
When you said returning soldiers that wouldn't take off their uniforms, were those soldiers returning from World War II?
Both World War I and World War II. I think, you know, African Americans serving in the military, going off and fighting a war, being given a gun by the government, was a real threat to segregation and Jim Crow and the racial apartheid that defined many parts of this country. And so these returning soldiers were viewed suspiciously by many communities. They were the sense they might now believe they are free and equal. And so humiliating them and not allowing them to wear their uniforms or not allowing them to assert that identity was one of the real sources of conflict. And there were horrific incidents in Texas and in South Carolina and Georgia where returning black veterans were ended up dying as a result of their identity as a former war veteran. You know, the demographic geography of this country is really shaped by lynching. We have African Americans in Los Angeles and Oakland and Cleveland and Chicago and Detroit and Boston. And the black people in these communities did not go there as immigrants looking for economic opportunities. They came there as refugees from terror. At the beginning of the 20th century, 90-some percent of the African-American population was in the Deep South. Over the next 30 years, the Great Migration forced millions of these people to flee the violence and terror that was controlling many of these regions. And so much of our current landscape in terms of demographic geography was shaped by this experience. And everybody was a victim. All people of color were traumatized. All people of color were disrupted and threatened and menaced by this phenomenon.
You want to see, and as I understand it, you are campaigning to see, markers, memorials to commemorate these lynchings, these events. Tell us about your efforts and what you've been able to achieve so far and what your goals are.
Well, I think that when you come to many parts of this country, the landscape is littered with icons and images that memorialize the Confederacy, that tell a story about our history, which is designed to evoke pride and glory. And I think, unfortunately, we haven't achieved the kind of racial justice in this country that most of us seek because we haven't been motivated to do the hard work that has to happen. I think there's a narrative of racial difference that has infected all of us in this country, and it begins with slavery. And we're not going to approach it and combat it and deal with it if we put up markers about the Confederacy but say nothing about slavery. And so we've been trying to challenge that. If you came to Montgomery, Alabama, 3 years ago, you would have found a city that had 59 markers and monuments to the Confederacy and not a word about slavery. So we've now put up markers about the slave trade and the way the slave trade disrupted life here. These 4,000 lynchings that took place in these 12 states are largely unknown to the people who live in these communities. And I don't think we're going to be as dedicated and vigilant to fighting racial inequality and injustice until we begin to deal with that history. And that's part of what we're trying to achieve. I do think there should be markers and monuments. You go to Germany today, and you can't go 100 meters in Berlin without seeing a stone or a marker that tells the story of a family that was abducted during the Holocaust and taken to the camps. Germans want you to go to the camps and reflect soberly on the history of the Holocaust. We do the opposite in America. We don't talk about slavery. We haven't talked about lynching. We don't really even talk about the humiliation and pain that segregation created during the Civil Rights era. And because of that, we're now talking about police shootings and mass incarceration and racial inequality in our criminal justice system with no context. And I think part of what we're trying to do is to contextualize this conversation.
Where have you been able to get markers installed? Where have you been unsuccessful?
Well, we now have markers around the slave trade in Montgomery. We've gotten approval for markers on lynching in about three states. We're really in the early stage of our work. We put out a report in February that documents the counties and the spaces where the lynchings took place. There have been efforts in communities across the country that have been turned around when people have tried to deal with this in the past. But I think we're quite hopeful that given the consequences of our silence and all of the damage that has been done by our silence on these issues, that perhaps there'll be a renewed interest and dealing with this history more concretely. You know, we really need truth and reconciliation in this country. You're not going to recover from something as devastating as slavery and terror lynchings and segregation without some kind of transitional justice. And I think now is the time to begin to see that happen. And we're seeing slow progress in some of these communities. It's still early in the process, but I'm hopeful that we can really change the landscape in a visual way that's important to everybody.
I would assume you get different reactions from white officials than you do from black officials.
Well, I think that's right. I think that there's just been a long practice, a long history of denying, not talking about, not confronting this, and it's unnerving for people to talk about some of these issues. But I've never seen a country or a community get closer to justice by only doing what's comfortable and convenient. You know, if you really want to protect human rights, if you want to achieve justice, you have to do uncomfortable things, inconvenient things. The civil rights movement was advanced by people choosing to do what was uncomfortable. And I think confronting our history is going to be challenging for a lot of people, but it's absolutely necessary if we're going to become the society we claim to want to be.
Brian Stevenson, the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, talking about the uncomfortable conversation he says Americans need to have about our historical legacy. Our next guest, a public intellectual who does not shy away from uncomfortable conversations, Ta-Nehisi Coates is author of Between the World and Me, winner this year of the National Book Award for Nonfiction. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine and a MacArthur Fellow. This fall, he came to our studios in Santa Monica for a conversation. During the civil rights movement of the 1960s, James Baldwin wrote The Fire Next Time as a letter to his nephew, urging him to help America become what it must become. Your book is a letter to your young son. You invoke Baldwin. What is your message? Is it different from his?
Probably. My message is about the communication of what the weight is of racism and white supremacy on African Americans in this country. It's I hate to use this word, but probably a primer, if you consider it directed to my child, about what I've experienced over the past 40 years and what he should prepare himself for and what he should gird himself for. I think Baldwin's book was much more outward-looking. It was, as you say, about getting the country to do certain things. I think I'm a little bit less concerned with that.
In America, it is traditional to destroy the black body. It is heritage. That's one of your lines. What do you mean by that?
Heritage is something that is part of, you know, your history that you repeatedly do over and over again. It is of some importance. That certainly is true for the destruction of the black body in this country. We had 250 years of it during enslavement. Enslavement was not accidental. It was a system that stretched back into our colonial history, into our early history, and it helped make us wealthy. In 1860, by the time we, you know, go to war during the Civil War, 60% of the exports out of this country are from cotton that went through the hands of slaves. If you wanted to find the greatest concentration of multimillionaires in this country in 1860, you would go to the Mississippi River Valley. The 4 million enslaved black people in this country who were regularly tortured and worked to death were a source of great wealth for this country. And then after that, for the 100 years that followed, we did not, you know, let this group of people go forth and pursue their happiness. No, we dogged them with the longest and the most lethal domestic terrorist campaign in this country's history. Governments either looked away or they participated in it when you talk about state and local governments. When we wanted to design our New Deal policies in the 40s and 50s, and we wanted to create the largest middle class in this country. As a necessary corollary to that, we cut black people out of a great deal of those programs. We segregated black folks during our housing programs. The result of that was, in fact, violence, more destruction of black bodies. The situation we have today in which police go into communities and patrol and we, you know, end up recording things on cameras are the result of those policies. Destruction of the black body is part of our heritage. It is the history of this country. There's no way around it.
You say and illustrate, it seems to me, very persuasively that it's more than policy. And you talk about the dream. What's the dream?
Well, the dream is the belief that anything that you've gotten, anything that you've done, or the right to acquire things has, you know, is somehow immune or somehow separable from the heritage and the history that I just outlined. The fact of the matter is everything that, you know, America prides itself on, everything that we as Americans, I don't want to separate myself from that, pride ourselves on, our liberty, our democracy, our choice, our freedoms. None of that was possible without the destruction of black folks. I mean, that black bodies, excuse me. Again, no, those are just facts. Enslavement is not incidental to the way this country developed its freedoms. It is not incidental to the great wealth that this country enjoys. Cutting black people out of the New Deal is how the New Deal was accomplished. Cutting black people out of our housing programs is the reason why we have this broad middle class that, you know, once we bragged about as the envy of the world. Those two things are not separable. The dream is the belief that you can extract one from the other.
You have written about reparations at length in the Atlantic. What do you mean by reparations, and why do you think reparations are needed?
Well, reparations is, you know, simply the repair of damage that was done. It's just that simple. If you take from a community over a period of time, you cannot, you know, hope to ameliorate or solve the problems that result from that taking without giving something back. What's behind that entire process that I outlined earlier, that heritage of destroying black bodies is the extraction, is the taking of resources. Just going back to those housing programs that I just talked about, it's not like black people were cut out and that had no effect. When black people were cut out of those programs, white families became richer, became wealthier. Greatest wealth-building opportunity of the 20th century, black folks cut out, even as they're paying their taxes into the system, even as they're upholding their end of the social contract, not receiving the same benefits. That is plunder. That's what it is. That's taking out of somebody else's community to benefit another group of people. If you look at our cities, how they look today, it's not a mistake. It's the result of policy. And the notion that you can somehow fix that without repairing the damage, without putting back at least some of what was taken out, is frankly lunacy as far as I'm concerned.
How do you repair in the present damage that was done in the past?
Well, we do it all the time. I mean, it's not like, you know, this is particularly new. I mean, if you want to speak directly about reparations, we gave reparations to Japanese Americans who were interned in this country. We interned in this country during World War. We've seen, in, you know, across the globe, reparations given at different times for groups of people who've had injustices perpetrated against them. It's not that difficult at all. You figure out what programs could ameliorate the kind of gaps that we see between Black and white people, then you make an effort to do so. In fact, you know, to a great degree, our entire court system, our civil court system, is based around that fundamental idea of repairing damage that was done in the past. There's nothing particularly radical when it comes to doing that for Black folks.
Your book is a letter to your son, and in it you describe his reaction to some of the things that we have seen recently, particularly having to do with police behavior toward Black people. Tell us about that personal kind of experience and how it led you to write the kind of book that you did.
Well, to be honest with you, I was writing a book before the reaction took place. But at the same time, you know, the fact that my son is growing up in a society where, you know, with some regularity, you can cut on the TV and see some video of a Black person either being choked or beaten or shot. We have to prepare our kids for that world. The Black world is so much more violent than other people's worlds in this country. And part of the book, certainly, is about preparing your children to live in that world.
He is growing up in a world where now there is more and more attention being paid to that. It's become, as you indicated, very public. It's all over the news. There's an association of sheriffs, police chiefs, and prosecutors who are going to the White House and talking about getting rid of mandatory minimums and other kinds of things that work to the disadvantage of Black people in this country. Are those good signs?
Sure they are. Sure they are. Yeah, they definitely are. I mean, certainly are better than the kind of signs we were seeing 25 years ago when folks were calling for more mandatory minimums and longer sentences. The problem, of course, is that we have wreaked havoc on a whole community. The incarceration rate in this country in 1970, was about 150 per 100,000, somewhere between 100 and 200 per 100,000, pretty much in line with the rest of the Western world. The incarceration rate right now is 700 per 100,000. For African American men, the rate is 4,000 per 100,000, way, way beyond anything that you know, we've seen. And so the notion that this can, you know, be easily, you know, drawn back, that we can easily somehow go back to the somewhat civilized system, not totally, but the somewhat civilized system we had in 1970, just by saying a few kind words at the White House is wrong. I would expect us to struggle with this for the next few generations. I don't think this will be as easy to repair as many people think.
That's a rebroadcast of my interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates, the author of Between the World and Me. You're listening to our favorite author interviews of 2015. In a moment, Motown and the Rise and Fall of Detroit. That's on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Warren Olney here with one more of our favorite talking points of 2015. Remember the Temptations? One element of what came to be known as the Motown sound. And Motown was just one of the things that made Detroit an important American city, along with Ford Thunderbirds and Chevy Impalas and organized labor and civil rights. David Marinus was born in Detroit in 1949, and his latest book is called Once in a Great City. David, welcome back to The Point.
Thank you, Warren. Great to be with you.
Once was a time in the early 1960s.
The book is built around 18 months from October of 1962 to May of 1964, when Detroit was luminescent in so many of the ways that you just mentioned. Motown was just going off on its first Motortown review. Walter Reuther of the United Auto Workers was not only bringing the working class into the middle class, but also helping the civil rights movement, where Detroit was a key component. And Detroit was selling more cars than ever before and conceiving the Mustang, which became sort of the sexy symbol of the 1960s. all of that happening in the period of my book. But I call it a sort of a shining star that was also dying at the same time. And the shadows of what were to come were evident as well.
Tell us a bit about the shadows before we hear more about what was luminescent.
Well, it was structural. And people often tend to blame the fall of Detroit on things that came later. The disturbances, riots of 1967, the pensions, municipal corruption. But you could see before that, in 1963, evidence of what was to come. Sociologists at Wayne State University predicted in 1963 that Detroit would be losing 500,000 people every decade from then on. Sadly, it was true. Partly it was the one-dimensional aspect of the economy there, the auto industry. Part of it were the results, sort of the reverberations of urban renewal, perhaps well-intentioned, but disrupting the traditional African-American communities.
What were the institutions that made Detroit a great city, that made it luminescent? How, for example, did Detroit come to be the place where the Motown sound began?
That's one of the great questions that I wanted to pursue in this book. Why do cities at certain moments have these bursts of creative energy? So for Detroit, some of it seems familiar. The movement of the oral tradition, the Southern migration, the great migration of African Americans from Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama, bringing that oral tradition and blues and jazz with them to Detroit. The pure luck of having this incredible group of talent right there, from Smokey Robinson to Mary Wells to Marvin Gaye to Stevie Wonder to the Temptations and Supremes. Some of it, the entrepreneurship of Berry Gordy, who founded it all. But two other elements were important to me. One was the fact that Detroit was this vast city with single-family homes, working-class people with disposable income, and pianos. There was a great piano company in Detroit, Grinnell Brothers, that brought the pianos into all the homes of the people that I interviewed who were part of Motown. And the last element were public school music teachers. From Mary Wells to the Funk Brothers to the studio band, everybody I talked to could remember their elementary school music teacher, their junior high music teacher, and their senior high music teacher, and talked about how that was so instrumental in what was to come from this great music.
You make a very interesting connection between the Motown and civil rights by talking about Aretha Franklin and her father.
Reverend C.L. Franklin, the most flamboyant, colorful, somewhat controversial preacher in Detroit, the head of New Bethel Baptist Church, Aretha's father, who was a friend of Mahalia Jackson's and knew Martin Luther King, and wanted to help the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1963, right after the difficulties in Birmingham, where King had written his famous letter from the jail and where so many of his people were hosed and attacked by police dogs during the demonstrations. Reverend Franklin organized a fundraiser in March in Detroit. 150,000 people came and walked down Woodward Avenue on June 23, 1963, went to Cobo Hall, where Dr. King delivered an early iteration of his I Have a Dream speech. He did it first in Detroit. Not only did Walter Reuther of the UAW and the progressive mayor Jerome Kavanaugh walk arm in arm with him, but Berry Gordy of Motown recorded that very speech.
And here is a segment of it.
I have a dream this afternoon that my four little children, that my four little children will not come up in the same young days that I came up within, but they will be judged on the basis of the content of their character, not the color of their skin. I have a dream this afternoon that one day right here in Detroit, Negroes will be able to buy a house or rent a house anywhere that their money will carry them, and they will be able to get a job.
Really almost eerie to hear that speech coming out of Detroit, which sounds so much, of course, like the speech he made later in Washington. You mentioned Walter Reuther earlier, and we just heard him saying that we want people to be able to buy a house, rent a house anywhere, their money will carry them and get a job. Tell us about Walter Reuther.
Walter Reuther, the president of the United Auto Workers, played a twofold role in Detroit and in America. He had the ear of Presidents Kennedy and then Johnson. He was very strong not only in dealing with the issues of labor and fair salaries and pensions and workplace safety for his people, but also was instrumental in the civil rights movement. It was the UAW and Walter Reuther who provided much of the money that bailed Martin Luther King out and his people out of jail in Birmingham. And they also gave an enormous contribution in kind and in financially to the March on Washington 2 months later. King, Ruther was a very progressive civil rights leader, somewhat ahead, I should say, of his rank and file, many of whom, those same people who he helped get those good jobs and salaries, moved out to the suburbs and not too many years later started voting for George Wallace. So there's this interesting tension between what the UAW and Ruther represented and what was to follow.
So here was all this extraordinary action going on in Detroit, and yet you said earlier that you could predict the decline that ultimately happened because of the structures of the city. What happened to the pianos and the school teachers and the other and the labor leaders and the civil rights movement?
Well, in a very singular sense, a lot of it died. Yeah, sadly, Walter Ruther died in a plane crash. Reverend Franklin was shot by intruders in his home and went into a 7-year coma. Motown even moved and went to L.A. The Mustang, the car I wrote about, sort of got fat in the late 60s, early 70s. So, and the school system started to deteriorate as people with taxpaying abilities moved out of the city and the city's tax base shrunk. So all of that led in some ways to the difficulties that were to follow.
Do you see the seeds of recovery in Detroit? Do you think it's possible that it could have a future, if not as luminous as it was in the past, at least better than it is now?
Oh, absolutely. I'm speaking to you from Detroit. There is an energy here. I'm a journalist. I try to be skeptical but optimistic. But I can feel the energy, especially downtown where a lot of big money players are coming in and investing in the city. Of course, they want to make money off it with a gamble, but it nonetheless is bringing so much into the downtown. There's a midtown area where the art museum is and Wayne State University, where young people are flooding in, you know, foodies and techies and musicians and artists. It has that feel of what Brooklyn was, a decade ago, of the place to come and invent yourself. So all of that is bringing this enormous energy to Detroit. The recovery is on its way, but there's a big problem, which is that you can't call it a true renaissance unless those vast swaths of Detroit, which are full of abandoned houses or people being dispossessed and jobless, unless somehow that is brought along with it. And that's a really tough issue that they're trying to tackle, but will take a much longer time.
Is Detroit emblematic of what's happening elsewhere in the metropolitan United States?
Well, I consider it somewhat of an exaggeration of what's happening elsewhere. Perhaps it hit rock bottom first, and so its recovery might pave the way for other cities to follow. Actually, as an example, it was for a decade or more, it's been kind of the symbol of a city of ruin. People would come here to tour the ruins as though they were going to Rome to look at the Colosseum and the Roman Forum. And that's changing.
That's all the time we have for this year-end edition of To the Point. To hear any of these segments again or to listen to more of our favorite talking points from 2015, visit kcrw.com/To the Point. I'm Marvin Olney. To the Point is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.